Welcome to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jennifer Winstall.
And I'm Leslie Kinchlow.
We're with the Winstall Kinchlow team in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can reach us at jennifer.winstall@ubs.com. We are financial advisors with UBS, one of the largest wealth managers in the world.
We are so excited to have meaningful conversations with a variety of guests. We'll be exploring their passions in business, entrepreneurship, and philanthropy.
Our mission is to bring purpose to life beyond the numbers.
Welcome back to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are pleased to have Brad Van Hoy join us in today's episode. Brad has over 25 years of experience in estate and tax planning, advising on estate and trust administration issues, providing counsel with respect to closely held business structuring and succession, and advising family offices. Brad, thank you so much for being here today.
I appreciate you all inviting me. Thank you.
We'd love to ask our guests about their background and the purpose behind their career. So would you tell us a little bit?
I will. Went to Chapel Hill for undergrad and had always planned to go through the business program there. And about midway through the business program, I decided that it wasn't quite for me. So I decided to go and get an English degree instead. And then when I finished that, I thought, well, what am I going to do with an English degree? And I decided to push pause for a little bit and went to law school, thinking that I would figure out my business career once I got done with law school. And what I discovered in law school is that the estate planning courses really interested me. They were a good combination of business and transactional work. And what's interesting is that my dad, who's a lawyer, a significant component of his practice is estate planning. And so it just kind of seemed to make sense for me that that would be a good area to follow. And so I think my father was really a big influence on me in choosing this line of work. And I don't know that I went to law school with a purpose. I think I have discovered my purpose as I have been doing estate planning and have gotten to work with clients, especially in this field, because when you are working in estate planning, you are providing advice to clients over very sensitive family issues. They're having to deal with their mortality. And it is a stressful conversation for a lot of clients. And what I've learned along the way is when you can provide them advice and direction and guidance in these areas, it helps give them a peace of mind and a confidence about what's going to happen if something happens to them. And so over time, I have learned that that is an incredible way to be able to serve other people. And it really has been a rewarding kind of discovery.
Yes, I think so. That's super meaningful when you can change someone's life that way.
It is. Y'all get to see it too, because you're helping on, you're helping advise them in a very similar way.
So I think we're going to jump right into the myths of estate planning,
okay,
Brad.
All right.
And a shout out to Andrea Chamakis, who we were having coffee with. And as a former estate planning attorney, she's now at Pendleton Square Trust. She was talking about just the myths behind what you do with clients and really who does need an estate plan. Is it for the ultra wealthy or is it for every person? So if you could talk to that a little bit.
I think there is probably a belief, a misconception out there that estate planning is only needed by those who are ultra wealthy. And the reality is everyone needs an estate plan. Not everyone needs the same estate plan or the same kind of planning, but everyone needs an estate plan because everyone at some point in time is going to pass away. Mm-hmm. And so they need to have a plan in place to help give direction for what happens with their estate when that happens. So for those people who think, gosh, this is only something that a wealthy person needs to do, I don't need to think about it or worry about it, I would say that's probably one of the single biggest misconceptions about estate planning.
Can you break down probate versus if assets are real estate, what have you, is passed down directly? I think that's a big question mm-hmm. we get frequently is what's private versus public?
It is. Probate is the process that, and it's an esoteric process, but probate's the process of taking a deceased person's will to the clerk of court and having that estate opened for administration to help decide what creditors have to be paid, what expenses have to be paid, and then whatever's left over gets distributed to the decedent's beneficiaries. Probate is a public process, and what that means is the will that you have, if you have a will, is a part of the public file. Now, anyone can go down and ask to see an estate file, and they're able to see the will itself, so they can see the terms of the will, who was named, who received what. They'll see an inventory of assets that pass pursuant to the terms of the will. So if you have an estate that is passes solely by the will, people can see exactly what you had and the value at your death, and they can see what people received. There are ways to avoid that public disclosure of what you have. You can't easily avoid having the terms of your will made public, but if you don't have much in your will and from a terms perspective because you've set up your estate plan through other means, then you can really provide a lot of privacy for what your beneficiaries are inheriting in that case.
So what would you say to those who say, okay, well, I've done my estate, I'm done, right? It's just a one-time thing. What would you say to that misconception?
Well, so normally I'd want to, my first question would be, how did you do your estate? What do you have in place? And they say, well, we've got a will, then I'd want to look at the will. But I'd also want to look at their balance sheet, their personal financial statement. Because what often happens is someone has a will, maybe they got it done 15, 20, 30 years ago when they had small children because they wanted to be able to name a guardian there. And they knew when they had a child, they needed to provide for something to happen in that case. But what often happens is you have a will and your assets, the way you hold them, the titling, beneficiary designations, don't line up with the will. And if they don't, the will almost becomes secondary. It may not accomplish the plan as you think it's going to accomplish it. And I would also say, and I think everybody knows this, life changes so often and so quickly. And what you may have had a lawyer put on paper 15, 20, 30, even 5 or 2 years ago, may not fit your life situation at the moment. Maybe your children have grown. Maybe your balance sheet has changed in composition or grown. Maybe relationships with family members have changed. And what you had put into the will from a perspective of its terms and maybe who you appointed to serve as executor or trustee of trusts, those things may have changed over time. So it's never going to be a one-time only kind of plan. It's a constantly evolving discussion that needs to be had between you and your advisors.
Well, and laws and exemptions change pretty frequently.
All the time. Yeah, so. All the time. I mean, you can, we were talking earlier, but you brought up the One Big Beautiful Bill had a lot of changes across the tax spectrum, but some of it was estate tax changes. State laws change. Local laws can change at times. So it is a constantly evolving landscape. And people have to respond to it, or if they don't, their estate plan may not do what they think it's going to do.
Yes. Now, what about those who just say, hey, I'm married. Everything's going to go to my spouse anyway. I don't need to have a will.
Got an anecdotal story for that. and what I think, again, maybe not a misconception, but an unknown about North Carolina rules, especially if you don't have a will in place. If you don't have a will in place, that is referred to as intestacy. So if you die without a will, you have an intestate estate. North Carolina, like probably every state in the United States, has statutory laws in place to say how a decedent's property is going to pass if they don't have a will. Well, the way North Carolina statutes work, it depends on the composition of your family at your death. If you are married, your wife or husband may get your property. If you are married with children, that changes the dynamic quite a bit because now all of a sudden the North Carolina intestacy laws say that your spouse does not get everything that you own. Now, some of it immediately upon death is going to become your children's property as well, which is rarely the structure that people would want. I've got a situation, and it's rare because most of our clients come to us because they want to do planning to avoid situations like this. But there was, I guess, he wasn't a client. A friend of his was a client, and this gentleman died unexpectedly. He had a wife and two very small children. He would have expected that everything was going to go to his wife, and instead, she got roughly one-third of the property, and two-thirds of the property was split into guardianship accounts for each of his minor children, which require a lot of reporting with the clerk of court's office. They're going to get the property outright when they turn 18. It is not the situation that this gentleman would have wanted, presumably. But because he didn't have a will, that's the process that's in place. So again, regardless of your level of wealth, if you want to be able to determine and control where your property goes, how it passes to your loved ones, and who's going to be making decisions when you can't, having an estate plan is such an important thing.
So myth number four.
All right.
All right. Estate planning is too time consuming.
It does require time, and it does require, I think, thought, and it requires clients to deal with their mortality, mm-hmm. which are rarely things that individuals want to do. But I would say that the time that is spent doing this ends up, one, being rewarding because you're going to get a peace of mind. You're going to have a lot more certainty about what's going to happen after you pass away. You're going to know with much more certainty that you've left your loved ones in a in the place that you want them to be left in, that it's very clear who's making the decisions, it's very clear what they're receiving, and the time that you invest in creating that plan and having the right documentation in place is going to be a lot less time than your loved ones are going to have to spend cleaning up the mess if you don't have a well-structured plan in place. And the level of stress that they will undergo is, I think, you know, significantly outweighs the time that's invested on the front end making sure you've got a good plan in place. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that play out, and I know y'all have too, mm-hmm. that you've got clients where they'll come back and say, sometimes, in fact, the best clients are those who have been kind of appointed or put into a position where they have to administer an estate that was not set up well, and they will look at me and probably look at y'all and say, I never want to put my loved ones through that. It was, you know, just a miserable experience. So I'd say, yes, it is investment. It is time consuming, but probably not as much as you might think. Mm-hmm. And the peace that it provides you and the certainty and the confidence in the amount of time it will save your loved ones is well worth it. Mm-hmm.
Well, and we often talk about the importance of powers of attorney. Mm-hmm. I think there is a misconception around just because a child is your child that you still have that power even when they're 18 and older. Can you talk about that?
I can.
For a minute.
In fact, I'm going through it in the moment. Our youngest daughter just turned 18, and we used to be able to make medical appointments for her. We can no longer do that. We can't access her medical records. She is a legal adult, and so she gets to take on that role now. It has, I think, times have probably changed too. When we went to school, I think parents were still able probably to access information and things at college. Colleges no longer do that. They are actually following the rules the way they're supposed to now. So when a child becomes 18, they are legal adults. They're legally responsible for themselves. And unless they have appointed someone as a healthcare agent or as their financial agent under a power of attorney, a parent really doesn't have the legal right to get involved.
Yeah.
And that can be shocking at times because lots of times, especially for 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, mm-hmm. parents are still paying the bills, but that does not give them the legal right to be able to make legal decisions or represent or get information mm-hmm. on behalf of minor children. And powers of attorney is a good thing to bring up too. I think people often think of estate planning as an at-death issue. Part of estate planning is also putting into place documents that allow for appointed persons, people in your life, to be able to make decisions for you if you become incapacitated. We're seeing a lot more dementia, Alzheimer's mm-hmm. out there. People are living longer, but they may not be able to make decisions for themselves, either financially or from a healthcare perspective. And you want to be able to make it very clear, if I get into that circumstance, in that situation, who do I want to be able to make decisions for myself? If you don't have a healthcare power of attorney or a financial power of attorney, it can become very murky and very, very complicated in terms of appointing someone who has legal authority to make those decisions on your behalf. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I'd like to clear up a misconception that estate planning is just an at-death thing. It's not just a will kind of thing. It is also a in case I become incapacitated kind of aspect as well.
Is your recommendation that an individual work with an attorney on power of attorney creation? Or, you know, there's a lot of do-it-yourselves out there.
There are. It's going to get even more... pervasive is what I will say. With AI out there,
yes,
there are a lot of do-it-yourself opportunities out there. You know, I see commercials all the time for, willandtrust.com or something along those lines. What I have found anecdotally when I have reviewed documents that clients have prepared through a service like that or just gotten something online is that they rarely work the way the client thinks they're going to, or they rarely put in place what a client intended them to do. So when I ask a client, I've reviewed your documents and this is what they say, more often than not, the response is, that's not what I was trying to do. That's not what I thought they would say. Those documents also don't take into account changes in circumstances, in changes in laws very well. An attorney is going to help guide a client. They're going to be aware of changes. They're going to be aware of the impact of language. They're going to see where there might be inconsistencies. They're going to ask questions. If a client says, this is what I'd like to do, an attorney is going to be able to say, to ask questions to make sure that's truly what they want, that that's the right decision for that client. You're not going to get that kind of back and forth with a do-it-yourself kind of plan in that case. So you may get the plan you want, but you may also get something that is completely counter to what
not
you were trying to do.
Yeah.
Granted, I'm biased
as
an estate planning attorney, but I wholeheartedly agree it is not worth the risk.
Yeah. Well, as practicing, practitioners, I should say, I agree with you. I would recommend a client not take the risk and they seek professional advice.
Y'all probably
like Dr. Google.
Yeah, y'all probably seen situations in circumstances where clients have documents that maybe they've done themselves, and you'll ask them the same questions that I would. Hey, is this really what you wanted?
Absolutely.
Yes. And again,
and we've seen some things out there that were not effective,
right,
and weren't as the client intended. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can we talk about tax a little bit here?
Absolutely. We want to make sure we put the listeners to sleep, right?
Well, and this may not be the case in North Carolina, but there is an inheritance tax in some states, right?
There are a few that still have that, yes.
We will often get the question, do I have to pay a tax when I inherit?
Okay. Yeah, there are some states. I believe New York still has an inheritance tax, and that's actually a pretty expensive one. There is a federal estate tax. Estate taxes and inheritance taxes can be somewhat different at times, but ultimately the purpose is to tax the transfer of wealth. I'm going to focus more on the federal side of things because fortunately North Carolina got rid of their estate tax many, many years ago. But there is a federal estate tax out there, and it will tax the transfer of wealth. I guess I should say estate and gift tax. That it's the same tax structure, but it taxes the transfer of wealth either during life or at death when that transfer is over $15 million. Well, beginning January 1 of next year, it'll be $15 million. It's just under $14 million right now. What that means is very wealthy individuals have to worry about an estate tax depending on the structure of their estate. If they are transferring wealth over $15 million and it's not going to a surviving spouse or it's not going to charity, and that tax is 40 cents on the dollar once you get over that amount. For the vast majority of individuals, though, there is not going to be a tax when they receive wealth. It's going to be sheltered by that $15 million federal exemption, and so they will get their inheritance estate tax-free.
I think you just touched on an important point, and that's the government's role in estate planning and how things can change under any administration. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because what we have in place today isn't necessarily what will be in place in 10 years.
That is true. Every administration has maybe a different viewpoint. And I think I'm sure your listener base is probably fairly aware that Republicans also often approach taxes differently than Democrats do. Mm-hmm. We were scheduled before the One Big Beautiful Bill, we were actually scheduled to have the estate tax exemptions expire beginning January 1 of 2026. A new administration comes in and is able to get those laws changed. Mm-hmm. And so now we have an exemption that is theoretically locked in perpetuity for at $15 million per person. But when a new administration comes in, if they have the ability through the legislative process and they've got a House and a Senate that is able to do it and they are looking for tax revenue, it is always possible that the laws could change in that case. So while we hope that this will stay locked in perpetuity, I think there's always a good chance that a new administration could change how the tax structure is and whether they're going to make estate tax changes or not. We'd have to wait and see.
So based on that, how frequently should somebody review their estate plan? I mean, typically we've said 5 years, but what is your suggestion?
My normal recommendation is to pull your plan out, or hopefully maybe you have a summary, because trying to go through and read those documents again can be painful. Right. But if you have a summary, once a year, I think it makes sense to pull that out and make sure that everything still lines up with what you have in mind at the time. If you have big life changes, and that can be the birth of a new child, the death of a loved one, family dynamic issues, because those often change, and you may have named individuals either as beneficiaries or to serve in a fiduciary role like a trustee or an executor or an agent under power of attorney. If you have a family dynamic change, you want to make sure you're looking pretty immediately at that. But at least once a year, I think it's a good idea to just look and see if the plan still makes sense. I think it's probably a good process if you are working with an estate planning attorney or wonderful advisors like yourself every 2 to 3 years to talk with them and see if there are any changes in the laws that might impact you that you might not be aware of. But at least once a year, kind of dust off the documents and make sure they still look the way you want them to. Good.
I think most people working today have retirement accounts. So maybe we could touch on the importance of making sure you get the beneficiary designation set up for those properly.
Yes. So the default, if you don't have a beneficiary, is to go through your estate. And that is a rarely a tax efficient way and rarely a probate avoidance efficient way of having your account set up. One of the nice ways to be able to avoid probate is to have beneficiary designations on accounts, and IRAs, 401ks automatically come with those. The typical structure is going to normally be surviving spouse if you have one, and then after that, maybe you're dividing it amongst your kids. You may have charitable beneficiaries that you want to name there, but the beneficiary designation is the way. It's the mechanism for distributing those funds, and because those 401ks and IRAs, unless they've been converted to a Roth 401k or IRA, they're going to be taxable to every beneficiary. That's a really good conversation to have with your advisors to make sure that the beneficiary designation structure that you have set up makes the most sense from an income tax planning perspective and an estate planning perspective within kind of the overall estate plan that you have in place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Brad, thank you.
Thank you all. Really appreciate the invitation to come and get a chance
to talk
with you.
Thank you, Brad. Brad Van Hoy with Morvan Allen, and we'll include your contact information on our website.
Great. Thank you.
So thanks for being with us.
I appreciate it.